Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi. My name is Nathan Hobson, and I'm a host for the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast, a member of the New Books Network. Today, I'll be talking with Dr. Nozomi Naoi about her book, Yumeji Modern, Designing the Everyday in 20th Century Japan. This is the first book-length English language study of one of Japan's most iconic 20th century artists, Takehisa Yumeji. And while Yumeji is most famous for his portraits of beautiful women and his stylish graphic design, which remain popular and even ubiquitous in today's Japan, his output was not only prolific, but also diverse. Yumeji began as an illustrator for socialist magazines around the turn of the century, and he was a key figure in the revival and reinvention of woodblock prints as a modern medium. He also produced astute and evocative portrayals of the 1923 Great Kanto earthquake, which devastated the Tokyo area. But Yumeji was also a mentor to modern young artists and writers, and as Naoi shows, he created not just a recognizable style and brand of his own, but also an alternative space of artistic production in the early 20th century. The book situates Yumeji's career within the evolving social, artistic, and technological context of his time, drawing our attention to his involvement with the new reprographic technologies and commercial design of the early 20th century. Additionally, by the inclusion of a substantial body of primary sources, including his 21-part earthquake reportage, in both the original Japanese and also in English translation, Naoi's book is both an outstanding and accessible art history book, but also a resource for future research and researchers. All right. So Dr. Naoi, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. And as is sort of traditional here on the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast, I wanted to ask you first how you became interested in this project that became your book, Yumeji Modern.
That's a great question. First of all, thank you very much for having me here. It's wonderful to have the chance to talk about my book. So why Yumeji? As you can imagine, it takes years and years for a book to come out, including all the research years. And during that time, there have been many things that impacted my work. I would say my interest in the printed material and reproducible media started even before my PhD, when I had the great opportunity to be at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. I started there as an unpaid intern, like everyone else in the museum field. And then afterwards, I was there for a year as a curatorial assistant. The MFA actually has the largest collection of Japanese woodblock prints outside of Japan. And I was there as part of their cataloging project. It was there, I think, that I really became interested in not just the beauty, but also the power of the printed medium, the kind of circulation, communal viewing experience that the printed medium allows, I realized was really powerful. And so I wanted to look at artworks and how it exists in a kind of larger social sphere. So that was the beginning of my interest there. When I eventually started my PhD program at Harvard, I was incredibly lucky to have two mentors who were leading professors in Japanese art history. And one of them, with one of them, I was looking at gender and the female image in Japanese art. And that's when I first stumbled onto Yumeji and his very famous images of beautiful women. It was later with my other mentor and in his approach with medium and materiality that I revisited Yumeji again. And those two, I think, really cemented Yumeji as a topic for my long-term research. Just to get us started with thinking about Yumeji, I think just to give you an idea of the kind of mass media output that he's done, so including illustrations, cover designs, poetry, essays, and even designs for free gift inserts, for example, he contributed to more than 2,200 volumes of magazines, journals, and newspapers during his entire career. So this really kind of melded both of my interests together as a topic.
That's really fascinating. And it's something that sort of personal history is something I of course knew nothing about reading the book. But I have to say, and I hope this, you know, you'll take this as the compliment it's meant to be, that I think your sort of curatorial experience shines through in the book, in the sense that it's of course very scholarly, but it's also very public facing, right? There's this sense in which it's a very open book that I think a lot, you know, a sort of wider audience can appreciate, which is something I know that, you know, the sort of public history and museums and, you know, curatorial sort of professions are very interested in. So I definitely sort of felt that. And I actually wondered, and you know, forgive me for playing amateur psychologist here. We're doing the amateur diagnosis hour. I don't know if you knew that's what you were signing up for, but I kind of wondered whether that's your sensibility that you sort of share with Yumeji, right? You talk about in the book the fact that he's this very sort of public artist, right? He's, you know, he's a master at what he does, and at the same time, he's also, you know, this very popular artist, right, in a sense, and he manages to be both at the same time. And I think that's actually one of the things that I liked about the book, and I hope that we can talk about it as we get into it, which I'd like to jump right into it and do that now. So let's first talk about the introduction, because there's a couple things in there that I think would really be helpful for the audience to understand before we jump into the chapters. So early on, you write that Yumeji's images evoke the era of the Taisho modern, yet his images also accord with our own contemporary aesthetic. And, you know, he's not just an artist, but a social phenomenon, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably still true here in Japan. So I went into the book not realizing how much he was multifaceted and complex. And as you say, how he's, you know, so productive and his art was so, you know, sort of wide ranging. So can you tell us a little bit more about Yumeji, the person and the artist, and what is it that in your mind makes him this sort of transcendental figure, this figure who transcends this, you know, century or so gap from when he was most active in the Taisho period to the present?
Yeah, that's something I've asked myself many times as I was writing the book, you know, who is Yumeji and how do I deal with him? And I'm glad you found the book accessible. And it is true that those are aspects that are really at the core of what Yumeji is as an artist and what his artworks are doing. And so I'm really glad that my book itself also emanates a part of that as well. But as you say, because he is so much in the popular sphere. And in Japan, everyone knows Yumeji. He is kind of a staple name that people know. And so that made it, in a way, both exciting, but also very challenging as an academic to deal with him. The question I also often asked myself was, you know, how do I deal with Yumeji as an artist? How do I deal with him as a person? And then, of course, how do I deal with his work? So those are some of the things that I was constantly thinking about when I was writing my book. I'm sure you being in Japan, you've been kind of noticing this as well, but just to give the audience a sense of how prevalent he is still today, you could walk into an ordinary stationery shop, for example, throughout Japan, and they would usually sell stationery items like notebooks and envelopes with images or design elements of by Yumeji on them. His cute black cat or botanical motifs are still very popular. People might recognize the strawberry motifs that are also the cover of my book in these kinds of merchandise as well. Uniqlo, for example, launched in 2007 its summer season of yukata with images by Yumeji on them. So, a common Japanese person would immediately recognize his images. And this is, in fact, I think very interestingly, along the lines with what Yumeji was trying to do during his lifetime as well. I call him the kind of Yumeji brand, in a way, in the book, because he was so good at kind of self-fashioning and branding his images and the image of him as a certain kind of artist. And he also, and this will come up later again, but he also created his own Minatoya shop in 1914, where he sold objects that he designed, his artworks, clothing, stationery, and all of these objects. So he was very aware of this kind of spheres of both artistic production and commercial production that he wanted to kind of brand himself within. Just thinking about the number of museums that are out there in Japan, there are 6 museums and 1 gallery within Japan that are solely dedicated just to his work, which is quite an astonishing number, not just compared to artists of his own generation, but even earlier as well. So this all was both exciting and challenging, as you can imagine. I think even many of the scholars today and the way that exhibitions are curated about his work almost fall into Yumeji's own spell of the kind of image that he wanted to create for himself. And this is very prevalent when we think about, for example, his iconic images of beautiful women, which are known as even known as the Yumeji-style beauties, or Yumeji Shiki Bijin. And so that kind of dainty female figure with an almost a kind of melancholic facial expression was a kind of perception that surrounded him even during his lifetime. And it kind of creeps into our kind of contemporary perception of him as well. He also used his own kind of personal, scandalous romantic affairs with many, many women, actually, as a kind of way to bolster that image as well. And so he, I think, really created around himself this image of the kind of very romantic and yet a little bit melancholic and a kind of free self-taught artist that was not tied down to a certain kind of artistic school, master, or style. I introduce one photograph in the introduction chapter that really gives you a sense of this self-fashioning. There's one photograph of him, a posed photograph from 1910, where we see Yumeji sitting on a windowsill, looking intensely introspective. He's dressed in a full suit. He's looking downward, and he's holding an Italian mandolin, which is a very exotic, foreign, newly introduced item in Japan during that time. And so you can really see him trying to convey the figure of the kind of modern, cultured, bohemian artist for himself. And I think we still fall for that image when we first encounter his works. Now, as a scholar dealing with him, I also, though, however, noticed that it's not just this that's part of his production. And so there's a really huge range, not just in the medium that he worked with, but also in subject matter. So what my book deals with is the kind of that big range that has illustrations and socialist bulletins with anti-war and leftist images, right? And then the kind of wrenching portrayals of the devastation after the Tokyo, the Great Kanto earthquake in 1923. So I was really trying to think about how all of these different elements actually are not just kind of disparate elements, but are that they have a kind of core fundamental element that tells us about the artist and the artworks and how they're engaged with the larger Taisho sphere. And the seemingly both frivolous, mundane, and the kind of serious, profound, and political elements, I through all of the chapters, I kind of see this as a kind of way that culminates to how he's dealing with the mediascape and mass media during this time, the kind of relationship between artist and audience through that, and also the kind of larger scope of what is actually happening during his time, which includes wars like the Russo-Japanese War. So those are the kinds of things that I see as a way to a moment in that early 20th century and a lens in which we see that, bearing in mind that in the context we have the rise in new types of rippographic technology and also the kind of emerging concept of the fine arts and concepts of what a design or designer is and all of those things taking shape in the background.
Yeah, so that's so one of the things that fascinates me, and I think was probably a source of your interest in Yumeji as well, if I'm reading this correctly, is despite that, you know, tremendous volume and diversity of production, as you put it in the book, right, Yumeji is, quote, canonical yet conspicuously absent from the official art historical discourse of modern Japanese art. Which that was really striking to me. You know, as somebody who's not an art historian, I would have just assumed that he would be, you know, part of any introductory textbook or, you know, whatever. So why is it that he's kind of left out of the canon, that he's hasn't been the subject of, you know, rigorous academic analysis? Does it have, you know, can you sort of, I think we will probably go into this a little bit in the chapters, but can you preview for our audience what it is about Yumeji that sort of kept him out of the canon?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. And it's looking at him and his kind of production. I think we start to see this kind of artist that is really close to the audience. He is not affiliated to the kind of newly established art academies of the time. And of course, much of his work is in mass media and the realm of reproducible arts. And at a time when these, for example, Tokyo School of Fine Arts and the Bunten Salon system are being established, which almost brings in you know, imports in actually rigid definitions of Western art that really starts with prioritizing mediums like painting and sculpture. And so suddenly in a culture where right before during the Edo period, when the printed material and ukiyo-e had been such a large part of the visual production, these kinds of reproducible arts, printed materials become almost kind of the other, the marginalized. And so I think that is also part of it. I'll speak a little bit more about this as well, but it's also the fact that a lot of his audiences and his core fans were also young women, which of course is another kind of marginalized section. So the kind of popular sphere, his interest in commercialization, the printed material, and his predominant female audience are, I think, a large factor into why he isn't a part of these kinds of the canon or the lineage, which of course is changing, as you'll see in the kind of different books in Japanese art history that are coming out recently. But also his lack of an official affiliation with these art schools during the modern era also makes him easier to kind of be simply dismissed as just a popular artist when these new and rigid definitions of what a fine art and fine artist is starting to emerge in the early 20th century. But you'll see, and I'll mention this in other parts explaining the book as well, that he, even though he himself is not part of these kinds of main trajectories, that he does have a lot of influence over how, for example, the printed medium starts to diverge in the modern to contemporary era. So I think this kind of reevaluation of looking at him as an important point in time for these larger trajectory was part of the aim for my book.
Yeah, and that's actually a really nice segue into the first chapter, which is the modern beauty and the Yumeji style, because you do take up this question of, you know, his audience being primarily sort of younger women, and also these questions about you know, reprographics and the sort of modernization of the materiality and reproduction of art, and you pull that all together under, in, at least in this chapter, the sort of theme of the construction of what you call the Yumeji style and to some extent the Yumeji brand. So I'd love it if you could tell us exactly how we should think about the Yumeji style and the Yumeji brand, and what that encompasses. And also in the book, you relate this to the sort of dialectic of production and consumption, and following Apajirai, the social life of the object and the social life, I guess, of the brand as well. So if you could tell us a little bit about that, that'd be great too.
What's interesting about the Yumeji style is that it has both elements within the actual works that he's produced, but then it also goes beyond to talk about actual women out in the streets during the Taisho era. And so that was a very fascinating point. And I wanted to start my book, the first chapter, with talking about the making of the Yumeji style, because I thought it was an important place to start to understand how he infiltrated almost his art, became part of the kind of day-to-day lives of normal people and normal women. As I mentioned earlier, his kind of the Yumeji brand and his self-fashioning led to opening of his Minatoya shop. And so there's this element of the kind of merchandise, thinking about commercialization alongside artistic creation. There's also that female image, you know, his iconic beauties that I talked about that was also shaped by the perception of the artist himself. And so all of that kind of culminates into making the Yumeji style that becomes almost like a conceptual entity that goes beyond just what we see is being depicted in his beauties, for example. It's even becomes a kind of social phenomenon. The scholar Takashi Ritsuko uses this phrase, the shakai gensho, social phenomenon. His beauties and his style become immediately a kind of recognizable type that people talk about. Before I introduce some actual kind of accounts of what people talked about them, I'll just point to one painting, Kurofuneya, which means Black Ship Shop. It's from 1919, and it's one of the most iconic Bijinga images by Yumeji. I have it in, I think, my introduction or the first chapter. It really kind of shows us the kind of essence of what people immediately recognized as the Yumeji style and the Yumeji beauty, with its single figure composition, dainty pose, again, the melancholic facial expression. All of these became that type that people immediately knew was by Yumeji. And of course, this is within the background of emerging new female types during the early 20th century, such as the Atarashi Onna, or new woman, and the Modan Garu, or modern girl, which became the object of discourse and visual representation. And in my chapter, I say that they don't necessarily, his images of women aren't just reflections of these new types, but they become part of the larger conversation of what a modern Japanese girl, or almost what a modern sensibility is like. And so his images then provided almost a kind of entry point for his consumers to project, and especially his female consumers, to project their own identities onto images of ordinary girls that were given central focus and attention within his work. And so I relate this with the kind of feeling of the community of girlhood and girls as avid consumers that the scholar Sarah Frederick also talks about. The part where it becomes even more fascinating is when we have records and accounts of normal people commenting about just normal women out in the streets being the Yumeji style woman, right? So this is beyond what we see is depicted woman by Yumeji, but these are actually just normal women. There's lots of, and I think I have a few quotes in the book, which I won't read here, but there's lots of accounts like, oh, someone called me a Yumeji-style beauty on the street, or someone saying, oh, look, there goes a Yumeji-style gal. And so we really see that this entity, this concept of what a Yumeji-shiki, a Yumeji-style, really just had its own life and was walking through the streets of modern Japan. And so his beauties then, alongside actual women who were called the Yumeji style, was a kind of a really tangible image that other girls could strive to become. And so it really got also entangled with purchasing then Yumeji goods from the Minatoya shop, which also became another way to almost inhabit the space of the Yumeji style beauty, and then almost in association become one. So he provides this world that is very much really about Yumeji, and yet very accessible, and almost you can step into it just by certain elements. And so what we learned, what the Yumeji style is, that it incorporates, of course, reference to very specific pictorial traits within Yumeji's paintings and prints, but also broader definitions of what a female type could be during the modern era into actual women that are alive during that time, that are all either consumers of his work or products, or somehow embody that sense of that kind of melancholic, romantic female that we see in his images.
Yeah, and I think that's really, you've done a really nice job of bringing out something that I actually thought was maybe the sort of most surprising thing for me as a reader is I almost felt like there's a whole other book that could be written about Yumeji by somebody other than an art historian, just from the perspective of like fan studies and thinking about the sort of the way that modern, you know, thinking of doing a media studies project and thinking about the sort of the culture of Yumeji that grows up, you know, a full century and maybe a little bit more in some cases ago. And that struck me as, you know, one of the real interesting things that you're pointing out in the book. And I'm glad that came out early on for our audience. So the thing is, though, of course, as you point out, that's not the sort of common image of Yumeji and his, you know, beautiful women and motifs, including the cover image, as you mentioned. That's not the sum total of his artwork by any means. And I had no idea that he essentially started out working as a socialist artist of sorts. And you talk about this in chapter two, The Socialist Platform, Yumeji as Illustrator. So this is Yumeji's early career, you know, sort of from starving art student to an illustrator for the influential socialist organization Heimincha. So, of course, we need to know a little bit about Heimincha itself, but could you also tell us how Yumeji finds himself involved in the organization and in its periodical Chokugen? And how his art is affected by this experience and also by the increasing government crackdowns on socialism as, you know, air quotes, dangerous thought after 1905. And what is how does that sort of fit into this story of the Yumeji style and Yumeji brand that is you know, the sort of larger trajectory of his career?
Yes, Yumeji's socialist illustrations are incredibly fascinating. And when I first stumbled upon them, I think I had the same reaction where at first I couldn't believe this was done by the same artist with you know, all of that iconic beauty images. But this is part of my larger point, actually, of my approach, is that although these elements like the socialist illustrations are often dealt with separately, like as a kind of his socialist era, I actually wanted to see this in a more holistic way. And I think ultimately understanding all of these different segments actually, I think, really leads us to the kind of fundamental visual and artistic stance that Yumeji has. So as you said, he begins his artistic career actually as an illustrator for these socialist publications. One or two of the kind of main members of Heimincha happened to be one of his classmates at the Waseda Business School, where he was only there for a little bit because he soon figured that he wanted to become an artist. But that was some of the kind of direct reasons why he began these illustrations. My book really tries to examine this relationship between these kinds of illustrations, both the socialist ideology, but also how his work in mass media and the kind of relationship that exists between subject matter and audience in mass media helps him start his career and build his fandom, of course, and builds that kind of style for him. Illustrations produced for Heimincha reveal his intense involvement with the movement. We do know that he went to several meetings with socialist peers and some kind of demonstrations as well, which is not something that's really known about this artist. And just to give you a brief introduction to Heimincha as well and their publications is that they were very much anti-Russo-Japanese war and the government policies regarding that. And so there's a lot of articles that you will see in these bulletins alongside Yumeji's images. Of course, Yumeji also, but many other very serious socialists stop doing a lot of these activities in 1911 with the Taiyaku Jiken, or the high treason incident, where a number of socialists were falsely accused, imprisoned, and also executed. That also is a point where some people have kind of almost accused Yumeji for only dabbling into socialism when it was fun, and as soon as there was trouble, that he moved on to something else. But in fact, many socialists, right, many serious socialists also had to stop, because it really was a matter of life or death. And even in Yumeji's diaries, there are a lot of entries saying that the police had visited him multiple times. And so it was really, I think, fearing his own life where he had to kind of look for a different outlet. And I think in many ways that was a good transition into a lot of the more popular images that he ended up doing with mass media. But what really helped, I think, his production because of this start in socialist bulletins is not just the fact that he was able to demonstrate his kind of political stance, which was anti-war himself as well, but also that it brought him the kind of support and emphasis on looking at the kind of day-to-day lives of the average person as an element, as a subject matter for his artistic creation. I'll introduce one image from this kind of socialist illustrations, which is one of my favorite, actually. It's called Shōri no Hiai, or The Sorrows of Victory, and was published in Chokugen in around this time. This is a striking image that portrays two standing figures, one a young woman crying into her kimono sleeve, and beside her we see a skeleton dressed in a man's kimono with a red cross on his left sleeve. Behind them we see a stream that is perhaps an allusion to the Sanzu no Kawa, or the River of Three Crossings, which is a mythological river that separates the world of the living from the realm of the dead. We see wavy lines in the sky and a small moon on the top right, which creates a kind of ominous mood and call attention to the figures' heads and upper bodies. This is in the larger context of the Russo-Japanese War. We see a portrayal of a woman who is shattered by the loss of perhaps her lover in the war. We see here the kind of start of him with this kind of focus on the anonymous girl, of her subjectivity and experiences, which developed alongside, of course, his political stance against the war, but really developed his interest for looking at the common people. And also, broadly speaking, circulating publications played a key role in how Yumeji's productions developed, where he became aware of a kind of impact that he had on a wider audience, and the kind of immediacy and closeness that he had between his own production and the people that were viewing them. And so all of that really builds the foundation for how his artistic career evolves into something else.
Yeah, so I thought it's a really interesting sort of contrast to what you're talking about in chapter three, which is commercial design and media, right? And I think there's this sort of disconnect, in a sense, between, you know, sort of thinking about this very, you know, socialist interest in the individual. And then, you know, but at the same time, he's also, as you said, sort of learning about the power of reproducible art and the sort of the power of popular art. And so in this chapter, reproducing the reproducible, Yumeji and mass media, you argue that the intersection of official or academy art, avant-garde art, and reproducible art enabled Umeji to nurture his art practice. But you also argue that simultaneously, his involvement with mass media and success as a media entrepreneur placed him in a marginal space outside official fine arts. And within this, women's magazines are a key medium. And I guess that's, you know, something of a jump from socialist magazines to women's magazines. But he emerges as this popular cultural icon that we've begun to talk about, and an exemplar of the modern reproducible, you know, sort of mediascape artist. So one of your examples is a department store magazine for Mitsukoshi, which is sort of the most prestigious of the modern department stores in Japan. I'd love it if you could start with that magazine and some of the things you talk about in the book to explain to our audience about his commercial design and the sort of ways that that impacted his mostly female audience, and then the tensions that critics saw between his success in mass produced media and mass reproduced media and fine art.
Yes, this is a great point. It's also what makes him fascinating, but also really difficult to deal with at certain times, because there are all of these different things that are happening. I think first I do want to point out that to our perhaps contemporary sensibility, that all of these spheres that includes fine arts, art academy, advertising, commercial art, and popular visual culture and mass media are somewhat, of course, related but disparate. But here, coming out of, coming out of the Edo period where printed material was just so prolific, and then entering the early 20th century when these categories are just coming in and starting to take place, and yet you still have a lot of artists that are dealing with all of these kind of different media and spaces that exist for artistic creation and circulation. And so I think it's a very interesting mesh of an artistic world that Umeji himself is in, and then what he creates in within his own world, a trajectory also for some of these materials in the future. At the same time that he really owes his popularity the visibility of his works to mass media, he's also at the same time trying to constantly reevaluate its value within this artistic sphere that is now starting to have discussions like the definition of bijutsu, fine arts, and things like that. And so I think almost that he himself is contradicted with these boundaries that are both helpful for him, but he also finds limiting. And also that has to do with his audience as well, when you said about his female audience and readership. And so we also see leading illustrators during this time, like Kimura Sohachi, who also writes about trying to put illustration as a kind of viable art form within this larger discussions of bijutsu. And so one of the things that Umeji actually does before the kind of Mitsukoshi advertising and all of those things is that he tries to then address the ephemeral and temporal nature of illustrations and to kind of elevate their status. And so one of the things that he did was in 1909, he published his first anthology of illustrations, which was called the Umeji Gashu Haru no Maki, or Spring Volume. And he compiled all of his illustrations that he had done for previously for other journals and magazines and newspapers. And he compiled them into an art book and into a kind of more permanent form, which he hoped was then would elevate it to the status of a kind of artwork in these emerging discussions of what art might be. So we see him both grappling with that side of bringing his kind of printed materials into a form that can be thought of as more of a kind of permanent artwork, at the same time that he's really utilizing the fact that printed medium, that the printed medium circulates and is always changing and is a kind of fast and more immediate form of work that goes to his audiences. So there is both of that sides, even within the medium that he's dealing with. Now, of course, there's also that two sides that you mentioned about kind of his political leanings and socialist leanings, and then also his young female audiences. Now, at first glance, I know this seems like very two different worlds, but if we think a little bit to back to our discussion about what about the kind of socialist bulletin illustrations that we really see him developing is really a focus on just normal people as his subjects. And in some cases, and in my book, I call this the giving voice to the voiceless. But in some cases, these kinds of normal people or females that usually aren't given prominent space in artistic production or elsewhere in society. And so his kind of view into these particular types of people and categories, it really develops that and is part of the reason, I think, where he really does start to cultivate a new demographic of female readership. Now, this is also reflected by the larger literary context during that time as well, where we see a development of magazines and popular fiction during the Taisho period, alongside also the rise in level of women's education in modern Japan. So all of these things help to coalesce what he's doing with his readership. We also see, and as you mentioned, Mitsukoshi, a rise in department stores and a different kind of shopping experience, and how commercial spheres start to then become part of artistic production spheres. And of course, Mitsukoshi is known for having their own studio where they had artists, even very prestigious artists from the Tokyo School of Fine Arts, who made designs for their new kimono line, for example. So there is really that mixing of these spheres that happened during this time. And we really see Yumeji as being in the kind of middle of it all, with all of these different platforms and establishments happening around him. That includes the kind of both the technological, reproducible media side, the kind of artistic and art school, art sphere side, and also these literary developments that fosters Yumeji's career in mass media.
Yeah, and you actually once again have done me a solid here by segueing into chapter four, because you just mentioned the Tokyo School of Fine Arts, and chapter four, creating an alternative space for the print medium, the Yumeji School and Tsukuhai Artists, is about the space and community of not the Yumeji brand, but the Yumeji School, as you call it, which is a group of young aspiring artists and writers, etc., many of whom are students of the sort of uber elite Tokyo School of Fine Arts. And they sought out Yumeji as an inspiration and as a mentor, as somebody who was part of a sort of alternative space of art that was, you know, growing up outside of the confines of the sort of, you know, stodginess of or sort of conservative, you know, narrow vision of the fine arts. And I'd love it if you could tell us what was the significance of the Yumeji School in the early 20th century art scene, and also specifically about the space of his shop, Minato-ya, which you mentioned earlier, in sort of aiding our understanding of the Umeji school.
Yes, Umeji's involvement, as we talked earlier, in mass media and these commercial spheres, and also having the Minato-ya shop, all of these, placed him outside these new kind of official art academy circles. And yet, he instead creates these alternate spaces, which was called the Umeji Gakko, actually, by the young artists themselves. Of course, it was a tongue-in-cheek because many of them were, as you say, students of the actual Tokyo School of Fine Arts. But someone like Onchi Koshiro, for example, there's a quote of him saying that I learned more from the Umeji Gakko, the Umeji School, than I had learned at the Tokyo School of Fine Arts. There is all of those accounts there. I pose this space as an alternate space rather than an oppositional one, just because it's not trying to, in a way, be against all of what is happening with these larger establishments. But it's also trying to assert itself as a kind of separate and different space that can also exist alongside all of these developments. As you see, I focus on a particular group of these young artists who congregated at this so-called Umeji School, which was just the second floor studio of his Minato-ya shop. These Tsukuhai artists who eventually goes on to form the art and literary group, also called Tsukuhai, which means reflections of the moon, were Onchi Koshiro, Tanaka Kyokichi, and Fujimori Shizuo. And immediately we know that someone like Onchi Koshiro really becomes the leading artist later on in the creative print movement and so forth. They start with and they seek out Umeji for, first of all, for the just the eclectic inspirations of art that Umeji has. So they spent hours and hours just looking through different kind of art magazines that Umeji had, for example, the Jugend magazine from Germany, these different types of styles. When you see works by the Tsukuhai artist, I think that visually we might be immediately associated with styles associated with the avant-garde in the West, like expressionism, cubism, and futurism. But it was really Umeji's engagement with the printed medium, the woodcut, and mass media that encouraged these artists to create their own magazine and to really take on the woodcut medium for their creative purposes. Their style did rub off on Umeji, and so we do see some of those kind of very edgy elements in his work as well after he works very closely with these young artists. The main point, I think, of bringing in this aspect into the book was that I wanted to place Umeji almost at the crux of the transition of the print medium that we know comes from the kind of golden ukiyo-e age of the Edo period into both this kind of popular visual culture field, commercial design that we talked about with Mitsukoshi, and then also to a kind of avant-garde creative production. And so I really wanted to place him in that kind of transitional moment where we see the printed medium take on two quite different, in a way, trajectories, but one that Umeji was engaged in both sides. In this chapter, I don't mean to suggest that Umeji was the only one that formed alternate groups in print media, because there was a lot of other marginalized spaces and marginalized visual creation because of the establishment of the Art Academy, for example. But I really wanted to show how Yumeji as an artist was very much embedded within these larger trajectories of art historical discourse in modern Japan, even though he himself may not directly appear in these lineages.
Yeah, I thought that this idea of creating an alternative rather than oppositional space, as you put it, was really interesting. I mean, the Japanese phrase semiwake, you know, sort of a to each their own kind of being able to live in parallel without, you know, necessarily having to wipe each other out was the thing that came to mind. And that seems to me to be a very interesting thing that, you know, the Yumeji school and brand and Yumeji himself were doing at the time. Chapter 5 continues in thinking about the trajectory of Yumeji's life and artistic production. And in a sense, it kind of takes us almost full circle, in a sense, back to his original socialist leanings, right? In the final chapter, you look at his reactions to the great Kanto earthquake of September 1st, 1923, which, for people who are not familiar, it devastates the capital of Tokyo and its surroundings. This is how I learned the English word firenado, is teaching about the great Kanto earthquake. Mm-hmm. So it was truly a devastating event. And what you focus on here is a series of 21 reports, which Yumeji produces for a Tokyo newspaper. So it's not a socialist magazine, but a Tokyo newspaper. And you argue that they kind of show his complexity again as a person and an artist. And to me, it seemed that there was this sort of return to some of his earlier artistic production. So can you tell us about maybe one or two of these pieces? I'd love it if you could talk about number 6, which was Jikeidan Osobi, and then maybe one other that for you crystallize and exemplify the person and artist and his response to the great Kanto earthquake, which you're talking about in this chapter, The World Turned Upside Down.
Yes, the sketches of the Tokyo disaster, I really wanted to end my book with these series because I thought it was important for Yumeji, and also it holds a kind of personal meaning for me as well, which I might mention later. But here I revisit again Yumeji as an artist and also this kind of contradictory figure, right, of his kind of subject matter and political stance. And I take the series as a kind of culmination point where we see the kind of compassion for the people and the sense of close observation of the day-to-day activities of ordinary women, men, and children, but also his very political anti-government stance. And then alongside also the kind of closeness and immediacy that we feel between the artwork and the audience. And so I take this series as that point that I end with. And again, he does have a lot of images that focus on the female as well within the series. And I also relate that back to how the cultivation of his Yumeji Shikibijin, his beauty, is also stemming from these kinds of concerns as well. And again, the kind of giving voice to the voiceless that I talk about. As a whole, you really sense Yumeji's almost camaraderie with his fellow Tokyoites in the struggle and the survival after this devastating natural disaster. I'm glad you really like number 6. It's quite a fascinating one. It's called Jikeidan Asobi, or Playing Vigilante. And the illustration depicts 6 children playing a game. Some of them are holding long sticks, and they point at the boy in the center. And in the text, we know that he's asked whether he can play the enemy or not because he just doesn't quite look Japanese. In the larger context, with playing vigilante, this is a reference to these groups that were originally formed in the aftermath of the earthquake to protect everyone. But in this period of utter chaos, however, these groups were known to abuse their power. And so Yumeji underscores this point indirectly through his portrayal of children play-acting these vigilantes. It's also a veiled reference to, and as you can tell, when they say, you know, you don't quite look Japanese to this one boy in the center, it's a reference to the indiscriminate violence against Korean nationals and other foreigners during this time as a result of circulating false rumors that these people were poisoning the well water, for example. They were completely false, and yet they circulated. And so there was a lot of lynchings that took place. So he uses the metaphor, almost kind of innocent depiction of children, to comment on the malicious adult behaviors that he is witnessing and hearing about after the earthquake. When we investigate a little bit more about these, we also know that there was a media ban that immediately followed these mass killings of Korean nationals that was only lifted 2 months after, in October 20, 1923. So we know that Yumeji publishes this installation and this this image before the media ban was lifted. And so it was a very risky and audacious move for Yumeji. And again, we start to then link back and see again the kind of bold anti-war and anti-government illustrations that he had done almost 18 years earlier for his socialist publications at the beginning of his artistic career. Now, I'd like to introduce one more, which is of a different kind of nature, because you see both in this series. And this one is called Chushu no Meigetsu, or moon viewing. And instead of concentrating on the kind of disaster, this one shows you a tranquil night scene with a mother and her two children that you see from behind sitting in a field and looking up at the moon. It's a poignant scene, and all the more so if you think about Yumeji's sensitivity and portrayal of his female images and, of course, his interest in the Yumeji style beauty. And so there is a romanticized natural setting with a kind of beautiful moment with the figures that is being communicated, even in a series that really dwells on the theme of destruction. The text recounts that Yumeji observed this mother was pulling pampas grass in the fields of Aoyama, trying to preserve the tradition of moon viewing for her children, even during such a traumatic time. And so we see the kind of really quiet moment, even within the tragedy that Yumeji focuses on. It's a very quiet and sensitive moment of a very normal kind of moment that you see. And we see the desire for people to create and preserve normalcy, even during this time, really touched Yumeji too, and that he depicted this. Again, we also go back to the fact that something like this was a serialization. So there's 21 parts to this series. And that allows for that close connection between his artwork and the viewers. And so as he is depicting and writing about his reactions and observations of what happens after the earthquake, the series also expands and builds upon itself as it's reacting to how different people are reacting to both his series and what is happening, what is unfolding in Japan during that aftermath. And so it enables a kind of memoristic journey that both his audience and Yumeji kind of experience together as the series comes to a final end with 21 installations. And so this is really how I bring together that kind of political and almost forceful side of his political stance that we had seen in his socialist illustrations, as well as kind of engagement with the kind of day-to-day mundane moments that we see both in the socialist ones as well as his kind of prolific production of Bijinga as well. And just to say that if anyone wants to read more about this image, I have a blog post on the University of Washington Press website just about the moon viewing image. So I hope that can be helpful as well.
Yeah, we will try and put a link to that in the blurb for the podcast, but do check it out. So you have an epilogue which treats the last decade of Umeji's career and his life. He passes away in 1934. And it struck me that this was quite a sort of different phase in his career. He moves out of his studio in Tokyo in 1924. He does a sort of autobiographical novel. He even travels to the U.S. in the early 1930s to pursue his some knowledge to fulfill a dream of creating a rural socialist art colony. And so I don't know if it's fair to read it this way, but it seems to me he's quite changed by the experience of 1923, as I think a lot of people were. And you observe that as an artist, you know, his popularity is somewhat on the wane in these years, even though, you know, his legacy is still with us. But in a sense, I think you're arguing here that the same reproduction and reprographic technologies that helped to establish him as an icon during his lifetime have helped to preserve him as a cultural icon for us. And I wonder if you could talk about that, those sort of the last years of his life and his legacy in that sense.
The last years are also a very different phase as well. And perhaps we would have seen a very different development if he hadn't died so early due to exhaustion and also illness because of all of that traveling. As you mentioned, as many artists after the 1923 earthquake, many people did move out of that Tokyo region into the Kansai area as well. And there was a shift in the kind of climate for these kind of cultural productions as well. Even before then, we sense a different kind of climate with the mounting government oppression and militarism that's already starting to show. But it really becomes oppressive for Umeji, I think, after the earthquake. And so he really tries to take a different turn. He almost, in a sense, tries to create a departure from his iconic Umeji style image, and to try to create a different persona or style for himself. And so he starts to think about kind of an art colony, and also perhaps I think he's hopeful that he can make himself into a modern international artist with his dream to go abroad to the West. And I do have articles about this specific period that's not part of the book, but what's really interesting, and I'll just introduce a little bit, is that during his time in the U.S. And in Europe, his political stance that we have been seeing since his socialist illustration days also is demonstrated again, where he's talking about the kind of struggles of Japanese Americans that he sees, especially in LA during the Olympics time. And then also when he is in Germany is right around the time when Hitler is on the rise. And so he, there's a few writings by him that mention how he empathizes with the kind of Jewish community there and their oppression. So we do see a continuation of that kind of element as well, and he continues to produce illustrations and newspaper series even when he is abroad. And so we see that sense. And it's really because his life was cut so abruptly, that perhaps his image, his self-fashioned image at earlier in his career is still kind of, there's that spell almost that we still feel. But I wonder if he had lived a longer life and he made a different turn, whether we would still be experiencing his work the same way.
Okay, so I think our audience is probably expecting that since we've just talked about the epilogue, that we are at the end, and I'm going to ask you about your future research project, which I do intend to do, our current research project. But I can't let you go without geeking out a little bit with you about your appendices, because they're fantastic and fascinating. And we don't generally talk about people's appendices on the podcast, I think, but you have this really fascinating collection of primary source texts, and it's texts and images in both English and Japanese for us, including all 21 installations of the Sketches of the Tokyo Disaster by Yumeji from 1923. So can you talk about how you both selected those sources and how you ended up including them in the book? Because I think, you know, they seem to sort of be a counterpoint or counterbalance to the prints and artwork that feature in the main body of the book. And they do a really nice job of sort of rounding things out. So I'd love it if you could talk about your appendix sources.
Thank you for taking note of my appendices. First of all, it was actually a really important part of the book and my research. And also, even though Yumeji is really well known in Japan, there's not that many academic books on him, and there's really nothing on him in English. And so I wanted to make sure, as an academic, that my book can provide a kind of easily accessible source for future scholars to think about either him or artists around his time. And I wanted it to really help future academics. And so I really asked my editor at UWP if I could include both the Japanese and the English translations. And I think I was incredibly fortunate to have a very understanding editor and team that allowed me to have such a long appendix. Some of them are primary materials from Yumeji himself. Others are letters by other artists around him. And so it really helps you to get that direct feeling of how people were discussing about these topics, his works, and what's happening in the artistic sphere at that moment in time in early modern, early 20th century Japan. And so I really wanted to show that feeling. The Earthquake series also, now that the book is out, I receive a lot of comments, especially from Japanese curators of museums that have really large collections of Yumeji's works. And they tell me that they found it very helpful and meaningful that I included all of that in my appendix, because it's a really different side that isn't dealt with a lot about Yumeji, but it is still a very important side to him. Also, it holds a really personal meaning to me. I included this in the appendix as well. But when I was in Japan doing research for this book, I was there at the time when the Tohoku earthquake struck northeastern Japan on March 11 in 2011. With the kind of massive tsunami, and it was a huge shock all throughout the country. And it was at that time when my host professor at Waseda University suggested that I look into Yumeji's response to the earthquake, which was the greatest natural disaster for him. And so I think this timing really allowed me to understand and have a kind of insight into Yumeji's heartful reactions that he has in his series. And I worked on the analysis of the series and the translations with the 2011 disaster in mind, which even years later today affect a lot of people. And there are still a lot of people who are not able to return to their homes. And so I really wanted to highlight that as part of my book and the kind of different production that we might really want to remember Yumeji by. This is, I guess, in our current circumstance in 2020, and also going back to the moon viewing image that is in the series, that I now feel that many of these reactions and critiques that we see in the series is ever more relevant today. And in a way, I hope that everyone is able to find, in a way, their moon viewing moment that helps us to remember the things that keep us human, keep us who we are, and allows us to persevere.
Yeah, that's very hopeful. I find that, you know, generally as a historian, when my work or the work of people I know becomes relevant, it's almost invariably negative. So it's nice to sort of be able to put a positive, hopeful spin on that. And I really appreciate that. Well, you've been extremely generous with your time, but I do want to ask you that question as promised, which is I'd love to know what you're up to these days in terms of your research.
I'm currently working on two projects. Well, I was working on two projects before all of these disruptions, but it was a natural progression from, I think, all of the interest that came out of my research on Yumeji. The first one is, it builds on what I did with the Mitsukoshi materials on Yumeji, but it's about Japanese poster design. And I examine the role of department stores, designers, and global modernism during the early 20th century and beyond. And I focus on poster designs, especially by this artist called Sugiura Hisui, who was the first in-house designer at the Mitsukoshi department store and the founding director of their advertising department. So I really look at the kind of transformation of the poster as a medium, as well as a kind of intersection between these spheres of the commercial and artistic as well. I'm currently actually in discussion with a prominent private collection of Japanese posters in New York, and am in the process of thinking about an exhibition of the kind of modern to post-war Japanese posters in their collection. So I'm very excited about that. And in a few years, there might be an exhibition in New York about that. My second project is examining the visualization of children and childhood in art, in literary magazines and children's magazines during the early 20th century. And this also started with Yumeji because he was also involved in creating illustrations for children's books during this time. He was also one of the first person to translate some of the Mother Goose stories in Japan. So that's how I got into it. But I wanted to look at the kind of role and value of children alongside the kind of formation of family identity, gender roles, and education and class in modern Japan. And I'm hoping that this project will take a more multidisciplinary approach beyond just the kind of visual and art history. So I have those two projects happening. If you'll allow me one final plug-in. If I know this has been a great interview, but because it's a podcast, if anyone wants to hear more about some of these images while looking at these images, I have two short videos called Highlights from Yumeji Modern on the website Envisioning East Asian Art History, which also introduces 19 other books, new books in the field. So you can check that out as well. Thank you so much for listening to me for a long time. And I hope everyone who reads my book enjoys it.
Well, thank you as well. And we will look forward to, well, personally, I'll hope I'll be able to get to the exhibition in New York, of course, but also we'll look forward to maybe having you back on the podcast with a future book about the representations of children, which sounds absolutely fascinating to me. And I want to thank you again for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.